Hi, and welcome to What's Next in Corporate Real Estate, where I take a look at what's going on in our industry by talking to an expert. Today, I'm thrilled to have Louise Rushmore in my studio at Cushman & Wakefield in Old Broad Street. I've known Louise for a number of years and know a little bit about her career, although when I was fact-checking for this, I noticed various gaps. I'm going to be poking and prodding to see what that's all about. So Louise, welcome to the studio, and how are you today?
Thank you very much, Michael. I am absolutely fine. Thank you very much. Just returned from holiday yesterday, so apologies if my jet lag kicks in.
Okay, we'll try and keep you awake with some caffeine. Right, I like to start these podcasts with a kind of a sense of anything to do with school and university and what you studied and maybe why and whether that led or how that led to your career in property. So maybe you could give us a little bit about your background.
Okay, yes. Well, I come from a family where I've got two sisters, both medical. So I've got a dentist and a physiotherapist. I was a typical middle child. No idea what I wanted to do, certainly not scientific. My parents were exasperated much of the time because I couldn't quite understand where my direction was going to lead to, maybe teaching. But actually, one thing that was quite clear that was that I was very good at hosting and dealing with people, but also I had a massive love of food. So the decision was made to do hotel and catering and institutional management. So I did that for 3 years. In Blackpool. Now, Blackpool may sound bizarre, but it was the best college for that HND at the time. And I had a phenomenal 3 years. I had 2 6-months out in industry working in hotels. And I tell you, you learn a lot when you work in hotels. You learn about 24/7 culture. You learn about how to party hard. You learn how to not sleep. But also you learn about dealing with customers, which I've taken all the way through my career from now.
That sounds fascinating. And just for those, maybe the younger listeners, an HND, you might need to explain that.
It's a higher national diploma. I chose to do that rather than a degree because I really like the work place experience piece of that, and actually working in industry and slightly less theoretical, more practical approach. And actually there was less studying, which really suited me at the time as well. So I did manage to learn to manage a social life, but also work in a hotel in the evenings and weekends, and they were long hours. So I did juggle a lot at the time and learnt a lot. And so those 3 years were fantastic. After that, I went to work, and this is maybe the gap you were talking about, Michael, at the Royal National Theatre on the South Bank in London as my first role, and it paid a salary of £7,600 a year as an assistant housekeeper. And it was a fantastic role. I looked after 100 cleaners over a huge estate. I think it was like 3 acres of estate, dressing rooms, stages. There's 3 theatres in the complex. I started off in that role. My boss sort of saw quite quickly that I was better front of house than back of house. And I then went to run the restaurants in front of house and then managed all the events at the National and became deputy head of front of house. And that was fantastic. By the end of it, I was running a team of 150.
And how long, just sorry, I'm going to interrupt because I've got about 10 questions in my head now. But you started at the National Theatre, so that was a job that you got as a result of your degree.
It is.
Even though you were in food and catering, you got a degree, you got a job running the cleaning team.
Yeah.
But was there a training at the National Theatre? Did you join a program that they shifted you around?
No, this was purely just because I did housekeeping as part of my diploma. But I think they recruited mainly because they wanted somebody with that experience of hospitality. And also cleaning dressing rooms is like cleaning hotel rooms, right? So it has a similarity there. But quite quickly, they were very good at developing talent. So saw that I was far better worth sort of front of house and dealing with everything from dealing with the actors and staff, of which there were 600, dealing with up to 3,000 audience members coming for events. And I used to run them. I used to do the theming. I used to run royal galas. I dealt with Princess Diane, Princess Margaret, had lots of royal events. So it was a fantastic experience. And I learned so much. And I've taken a lot of those fundamental learnings, running an operation, running budgets, right the way through my career.
And then how did you, I mean, that's really fascinating, but it sounds to me like one, you got promoted pretty quickly. And I'm curious to know, was that, given that there wasn't a formal program, was that you pushing for bigger and bigger roles, or were they just coming to you every 6 months and saying, you did that well, here's the next job? And then the sort of second part, which is sort of related, but clearly you, I guess you're a people person by the sounds of it, because you were dealing with all those front of house people. But how important has that been, or was that in that part of your career? And because that's not something you learn at university, yet it seems to me it's an integral part of anyone's career.
Really good questions. I think the first thing was I did very much push myself. I made sure I got to know the right people, and I worked really, really hard. Whenever there was an opportunity for training development, I put my hand up, push myself forward, and it was part of my nature. And I am a people person. I think one of the biggest things I now advise my children, but also my nieces and nephews, is that they need to start developing their network as early as possible. And I have developed my network right the way through my career. Some may say sort of slightly too far, because actually I did marry the head of front of house at the National Theatre, and now we've got two children. So that maybe people think that might have taken it too far. But no, that has been hugely important to me. And I think being able to deal with customers, colleagues, clients has definitely helped my progression in the industry.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I think that's really important. I have to say, from a without making a huge generalization, I think I was very lucky, because when I was going through my career, my wife was elected to stay at home. So I kind of had the freedom to go out and do a lot of things, not only during the day, but evenings. But how did you juggle that part of your career? Because it can be harder.
It really can be hard. Having a great employer really helps. So I had two young children while I was still at the theatre. In the end, I did actually choose to, because I was working full time, and it's evenings, weekends, and juggling's really hard. But I made a decision to move roles at that stage. And I saw in a role advertised as a part-time hospitality coordinator for a financial printing company called R.R. Donnelly. So I thought, okay, I can do that. It's hospitality. It's my thing. When I got there, I realised quite quickly it was actually facilities management. Not that I knew what the word was, but I was running their offices for them in Paris, London and Frankfurt. And for 3 months, I worked 3 days a week. But then after 3 months, they said to me, oh, we're relocating our city office. You do that sort of thing, don't you? here's a budget. Go off and do it. And so I then started working full time, and I managed to design their city office as I would using my hotel experience and my front of house experience. So the whole office was designed around the clients, and it was absolutely mind-blowing for this American company who had the corporate offices designed in the same way. But I totally designed it completely differently, and that then became the blueprint for the global footprint. So it then became a global role, and I was there for 6 years and had an absolute ball.
And I think I'd like to come back to that maybe towards the end of the podcast, simply because I want to talk about what's coming next. And I think what you were clearly doing many years ago is what a lot of people think is what's next now. Before we dive into that, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned finance a couple of times, and it strikes me as being one of the crucial parts of any business and real estate, no less so, that you understand the numbers around whatever you're doing. So what does it cost to do whatever you're doing? What's the profit element of a piece of work you're doing if you're service provider side? And I'm not sure how much of that is embedded in any of the traditional training, let's say. So and maybe you got a lot of that at university, I don't know, you have a mathematical background, but I think a lot of people struggle with that, yet it's so crucial.
Now, I don't have a mathematical background. have always asked the basic fundamental questions whenever starting a role. And one of those is, what is my budget? What is my operating costs? What is the value we're getting from our suppliers? Are we getting the best value? Are we getting the best value, the best service for our bang for our buck? And that for me has, again, been something I've kept really close to me. And I always empower when I develop my own team is say, understand how much things cost. How much is the cost per square foot? Not just of the real estate side, the FM side, the whole total cost of occupancy. And I don't think they often can answer that question. And I would expect all my team to have that information to hand. And actually, my memory's not so good. So I have an aide memoir, the back of my black book, of all the key budget information, all the key MI that I may need if any of my key stakeholders ask. If they say, how much does the catering cost? I always have a reference. So I don't necessarily, I'm not an expert myself, but I make sure I have all the tools, but also the right finance business partner to help work with me to make sure I do get best value.
Yeah, and that's a really neat way of doing it. Walk around with a book and have the answers in. So when you get into the lift with the CFO and he asks you a question, you can look up the answer if you can't remember it.
I also give it to my key stakeholders because they're often asked. It's not me. It's often, in board level, they're asked, well, how much is this building cost a year? What's the total cost of occupancy in Europe or whatever? And actually having those key facts has been one of the key things I've used all the way through.
There's a couple of things you touched on there, which maybe we could explore a bit more. The first is when you said when you've got your team around you. So you talked about the National Theatre and moving from being in charge of cleaners and that growing, and then your temporary role. But and you've now, as we all progress in our careers, we end up with people working for us. Mm-hmm. How do you go about? I was going to say training, but inspiring is probably a better way of asking the question. Inspiring that team to do, not only to learn from what you do every day, but inspire them to be the best at their career, or maybe you see that they need to move jobs and not work for you anymore, and particularly when they're not doing what you want. How do you create that sort of team environment, which is so important to people progressing?
It is. And it's something I get a huge amount of enjoyment out of, really developing my team. I do that by providing a vision, first of all. This is where we want our business to go to. This is the direction of travel. This is where we are today. This is where we've got to get to. How, as a team, can we get there? I'm not going to tell you all the answers. I'm very much a person who empowers the team. I manage by trust. I manage by output. And, everybody says it's how things are done these days. It's actually not a lot of the time. I have to say I get a fantastic amount of loyalty from my team by using those tools. But also, if things don't work out, I'm really honest, really open, really direct. I also like to think that I'm someone who comes in every day. I have a very positive, and I hate the word passionate, but a very engaged style. I like to walk in the room, say hi to everybody, how's your weekend? Understand there's things outside of this sort of work life, this work life blending, or whatever we call it these days.
I think passionate's a good word to use, and also curiosity, but because there's a lot of people who will come to the office and do the job from 9 to 5 and go home, and then you don't get that, I don't know what you might call it, collegiate or team spirit building. So I would have thought that was a good way of gaining the trust of people and therefore getting their best work.
I think one thing I'd like to say here as well is that don't assume too much when you're moving to a new team. At one role I was in, I assumed the team was up for a huge amount of change because it had been stagnant for a very long time. People had been there for a very long time and they were looking for something different. I think I've worked for a few companies who want immediate change. I've worked for others who struggle with change. And actually going into this one role where I thought change had to happen quickly, actually, you have to make sure all the team's on the bus with you or have a really clear communication plan around change. And actually, change that I thought was quite small, insignificant little things were huge for certain individuals. And I think that's something I've really learned. It's just really understand what impact you have and what impact change, which you may think is minor, can have on people.
Yeah, and I've certainly fallen foul of that more than once. And you do have to remember it. Everyone has a different rationale for being at work and are at a different point in their lives, both personally and professionally. And unless you ask those kind of slightly pointed questions, you don't know what you're up against. And of course, your enthusiasm and leadership is one thing, but some people just aren't up for it.
No.
At least want to understand. I guess it's back to personality type. Mm. Some have to understand all the detail before they get on the bus. Others go a bit sort of a bit more carefree and just get on the bus and see where they end up and everything in between, right?
And actually doing some of those sort of personality profiling with your leadership team can really help to really draw out those different styles. And I need all those different styles, the cynics that might be perceived as cynics. I need those people who can stop, take stock, really think about things and analyse situations. And I really value that. So I do think leadership, trust and vision is important, but also just making sure that people feel as though they can say exactly what they think in a safe environment. I really want the team around me to feel valued. And that's maybe an overused word, a bit like passionate, but I think that's all about workplace culture as well, and actually coming into work really feeling valued, whatever you do. And I think my sort of hospitality background of understanding the importance of a kitchen porter right through to the MD, CEO, and treating them in exactly the same way has really helped me get to where I am today, because you need everybody to help you deliver what you need to.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. Treating everyone in the same way with the same amount of respect is hugely important, and it's easy to forget that. So bringing it back to R.R. Donnelly, who I remember, US-based paper company, if I remember correctly.
Printing company.
So you went there for the part-time role for the reasons that you explained. They then said, well, this is a great job. Yeah. You're doing a great job. So it then became full-time.
Full-time after 3 months, and I was there 6 years.
And you were there 6 years.
Yeah. I outgrew that role by the end.
Okay, you guessed my question.
I outgrew it. But it was a great experience. I think one of the things I learned there is dealing with Americans. I mean, my boss... Sorry, I love Americans, by the way. I've just come back from America. I absolutely love it. But my boss was from New York, and he'd arrive in the office at 7 o'clock in the morning, and he'd stay there till 7 o'clock at night, and nobody could leave until after he'd left. So that culture really was interesting and something I hadn't really experienced before. And also their directness and style. I learned to really work fantastically well with them, especially in New York. Was offered a role in New York, but because I had children, decided not to take it. So I left there and went to Barclays Wealth. I think that was next. Or maybe it was. I'm sure that was next.
Sorry, just before you go on, that's kind of interesting. So you had a career decision to make, which was go to New York for a bigger role.
Or leave the
business. You chose family quite rightly. But was that an easy decision? I mean...
No, because I actually accepted the role.
How did I know there was a story in there somewhere, Louise?
Oh, dear. I accepted the role because I really wanted it. The problem was, obviously, my husband had a big role over here. He would have to give that up. And it wasn't a two-year assignment. It was a permanent relocation. So I sort of got cold feet.
Understandably.
No regrets. But I've still got lots of friends from that period of time.
I can tell you another time. I lived there for 13 years working, so...
Did you? Wow. We should have a chat about it.
Yeah. Okay, so you didn't take that role, but I think that's kind of an interesting, important, because those are sort of career things that happen to everyone and you have to make big decisions. So having made that pretty big decision, you then decided you really need to leave, and you said you went to Barclays Wealth. Was this in an FM role, or?
So I had a fantastic start to that career. So my father was a director of Barclays Bank. He was the youngest ever bank manager at 17 or something years and years and years ago. So I decided to go and work for them at Canary Wharf. Not a massive fan personally of the Canary Wharf environment, but that's a personal thing. I was employed as a service excellence manager. So all that sort of experience of delivering excellent service, which I've had over the previous years, they wanted to really deliver in their high net worth new site, which they spent millions at this fantastic location. But what they wanted was the service inside to be as good as the upgrade that they'd done to the facilities. And I never forget, one of the reasons they told me that I was brought in was that Bob Diamond went into the office one day and the reception asked who he was here to see and who he was, which isn't a good move. So that then led to them wanting somebody to completely overhaul that service, which I absolutely adored, loved, did that quite quickly. And then the role developed into more of a theoretical, continuous improvement role, looking at global standards, which was great for the areas I really were interested in, front of house, the FM side. But there were some aspects of it I really have to say, a bit of a square peg in a round hole. So writing process maps, doing presentations that really I didn't necessarily feel that was didn't really suit my style. So
but that can sometimes happen in a job there. You either outgrow it or it outgrows you, or it goes off in a direction that isn't for you, and that's not a reflection on you or the business.
Role, no.
I mean, I think the key thing is to recognize it.
Yeah.
And then do something about it.
Yeah, you're right. And I think there it was definitely a situation of square peg and round hole. I felt really uncomfortable at the time doing this whole process part of the role. Didn't really enjoy it, but it was actually fantastic learning and an area that, again, I've taken with me. Even though it was probably the most painful part of my career to date, I absolutely learned so much, which I've taken forward. So I was approached by one of my network to see whether I'd be interested in joining Royal & Sun Alliance Insurance, running their UK HQ in Leadenhall, the Leadenhall building. So I joined them and had an amazing 6 years with RSA. First of all, I started off running their head office. I learned about cooling towers and L8 and all those regulations. I learned a lot about M&E, something that up to date hadn't really had too much involvement in. Learned to trust really good engineers and also learned enough to get by. And then my boss was actually taken off on a strategy project, so I was asked then to run the UK. So I ran the UK operations, so that was buildings all over the UK, and a team, a national team, which I found really great. So that's really running an operation, running suppliers, running budgets. Then the role developed into strategy, which again is an area which I think a lot of people struggle with.
So. And when you say strategy, so now you're moving out of the pure FM, running the estate,
yeah,
cleaning it, feeding people,
yeah,
security, all of those things, and now you're
into
talking
the real
about
estate.
Into the real estate
I was
part.
Into the real estate part, and that was fantastic because I worked with Cushman & Wakefield, and they really helped partner with me thinking about what we're going to do with the legacy estate, what we're going to do with the occupied estate, what opportunities there were to really sweat the asset and maximise the occupancy. And so that whole aspect was fantastic to learn. And again, a great sort of tool to my arsenal, if you like, a weapon to my arsenal, which really helped sort of me become way more rounded. And the best thing about that was, obviously, my style is quite chatty, and I meet and network with colleagues, but also the boards, the various UK board members, and property reported into HR. And I became fairly good friends with the HR director. When I say friends, colleague of the HR director and fairly trusted ally. and they wanted to move their HQs into one HQ at the walkie-talkie. So they had their UK emerging markets and group HQ. So group UK emerging markets. They wanted to halve the footprint, move into the walkie-talkie, save $5 million a year, move to an agile working environment. They had someone running the program. He didn't work out. He was reporting to the board. The CFO had a massive interest in design of the new space, so which is always dangerous. The program manager questioned his involvement in that. So he was moved off the project, and I was asked if I'd lead the program. So leading all work streams from IT to construction to legal to FM. And I had 2 years of going into the walkie-talkie, taking it from shell and core, having steel toe caps, planning the space, designing the space, reporting to the board for 2 years, and the chairman, which was a fantastic time. I think the highlight of that was when the glare happened. You may recall there was a burning car.
Jaguar.
There was a death ray from the walkie-talkie that melted a car's wing mirror. And we were the first occupants in. We had spent $10 million on the design and fit out. We're the first occupants in. I designed all the boardroom and the offices over the Thames. It was a fantastic view. It looked amazing. Nobody else had done any fit out by that stage. But then this death ray happened, and they decided, Canary Wharf and Nansec, the best solution to this was to put Brie Soleil on the external, which is like horizontal slats on the outside of the building. So my beautiful view, we bought uninterrupted views over the River Thames. Now they look like little prison slats. So these, and the other thing is the offices that we designed were tiny, because we only had offices for the board members. So now they had little cells. Oh, dear. So that was amazing, because that happened. The chairman said to me, Louise, we can't move in. We need to find somewhere else. The lease was up. We had to move. We had to make a decision. So I was put in a quite high-pressured situation there. But went back to the chairman, said, actually, we don't have an option. They've come up with this solution. Let's negotiate a deal, which is what we did. And I got all the other tenants who had leases in that building to work with me and to work together. So we all had one voice, because what I've figured out quite quickly, if another tenant said, actually, we're quite happy with Brie Soleil, you know, where's your negotiating position? So from a little sort of hospitality person to then leading sort of high-level negotiations with Landsat and Canary Wharf and going to their top boardroom, I thought, I got a bit of imposter syndrome by that stage. And I think that's another thing I'd like to highlight, is that we all feel it.
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I just felt like, what am I doing here? I shouldn't be here talking millions of pounds. Yeah,
long way from an HND in Blackpool.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was going to ask you, because, I mean, there's about 20 questions in that last little vignette, but you're now at a position where you've moved yourself to a position where you were doing things outside your core competence, meaning FM, and you were interacting with board members, who, as we all know, is very different to interacting with outsourced contractors and so on and so forth. So were you trained in any way, shape or form, or was it all this things you learnt as you went?
I learnt as I went. And the key things I learnt from that was prepare. So we had steering group meetings every month, and I had the best presentations that everybody had rehearsed. Everybody knew their slot. We kept it to time. It was slick. We knew our numbers. They trusted us. They trusted us in the project.
Back to the numbers.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, that's what they want to know.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we're on time. We're on budget, or under budget. And they were absolutely delighted with the outcome. The other thing during that whole 2 years, though, was understanding the impact of cultural change, because I thought we had quite a large, substantial budget for the communications work stream, which was all about telling people, you're moving from your desk to our space, we're going to manage you by output, it's all going to be different. Oh, it was the hardest work. Doing the actual building was the easy bit. Changing mindsets was absolutely tough as nails. It was the hardest thing. And I still think that's the hardest thing to get right. And if it's done well, which it was here, but we invested in it, it was fine. But I think people's emotions, people's hearts and minds, and we were letting a few people go as well. So that also was quite difficult. But I think really getting your communication plan right for that was critical, but also showing them the vision, back to vision. You know, we had to bus people up to Vodafone to show them what a new working environment would look like and what it would mean to them, getting advocates in to start making the change ahead of the move. And so again, that was another aspect that I learned on the job. So all my training's not been theoretical. It's been very much practical and learning as I've gone along.
And I guess that comes back again, I think, and you've mentioned it a few times now, but one, having a network so you can call people up and say, hey, I'm doing this sort of project. I know you've done one. Can we talk about it? So you learn from other people in the industry. And if you don't have a network, that's much harder to do. And staying curious. And then again, I'm sure back to having a really good team around you and people who are prepared to sort of muck in and figure things out. And that's what makes the role so exciting. It's a good thing to, in some instances, to figure things out as you go, because that keeps you very focused and thoughtful about what you've got to do.
I think the network point is not just network as such, but it's really good suppliers, really good people who you can go to, who you can trust, give you the best value. And I have seen it done really badly. I've seen suppliers being sort of hit with a stick rather than partnership. And I do agree with the partnership approach. And I think if you are an intelligent client and you can partner well, because you know what questions to ask along the way, I think it can really help. So that's where I also see my network.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. Okay, so that's the RSO. You've moved everyone into the walkie-talkie. You've dealt with a death ray from the Death Star.
Yes, I have. And when I took the role on, I knew the 2 years was it. I had a two-year deal. It was like, you can do this. It's a golden handcuff deal. We'll give you money to do this. And if you stay and complete it, goodbye after that. There's not going to be a role for you, because I'd taken that chance. And I knew after six years was a good stint, and I knew that the time was right to go after that.
So the 2 years comes to an end. You've moved everyone in. Maybe we'll skip ahead, but private equity role?
So I was at a company called Canopius, an insurance company, happy there. I was called up through LinkedIn. I'd say LinkedIn is an amazing network if you're looking for a new role. I was contacted by the COO of an IT recruitment company. They were massively growing, doubling in size globally. They needed someone to head up property. They didn't have anybody doing it at the time. Lean and mean, just me. They said, okay, all officers. Can you start 1st of July? And actually, we need to open in Philadelphia for 250 people in September. Can you do it? Yeah, I'm sure I can. And this is, again, back to the sort of person I am. I just say yes and then work it out. Well, not always say yes, but I do put a cautionary note if I do or feel worried at all about it. But I decided to say yes to that the week before, which I managed, week before I opened in Berlin. And then Dallas, and I went all over the world opening offices for them, having an absolute blast, got equity in the company. It was very lean and mean, so I reported into the board. I sat in board meetings, absolutely loved it. But there, what they wanted to do was to fill their offices with recruitment consultants, sweat the assets so much that they just wanted to cram people in. And I started flagging the question, hold on a minute, have you looked at your turnover here? I mean, 50% turnover. People weren't happy there. They were working long hours. They were in uncomfortable chairs. And I remember that I said, these chairs are just awful. They're in there for 12 hours a day. And actually, it was... There were cheap chairs, and I really started explaining about the importance of the workplace and giving them a great culture, not just getting them in in there, but actually well-being and giving them fruit, giving them some nicer chairs. But they wanted to know that return on investment. It's all about the money. And it took a long time for them to really understand that. But, you know, they did start to listen. They also got an HR director in who was supportive, and I had an ally there. But I understood they needed to get everything done as lean and mean as possible. But it was great culture. It was sales days. It was all about, you had to sort of take health and safety at its most sort of basic principles, because they do all sorts of games in the office. You didn't want to be in health and safety police, but you needed to highlight certain things that they were doing in a very nice way, if you like. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Wasn't looking to leave. And then I got a call from Virgin Money. They had been trying to recruit for a head of property for over a year. They wanted someone with the right cultural fit who really wanted to lead change to a large team. So I went from a team globally of 8 people to a team of 77 for a UK ex-Northern Rock. Fabulous, fabulous people, fabulous environment. Really, really loved it. And it was a hard decision to leave this private equity company because, as I say, I had a stake in the company. I was potentially going to lose quite a lot. But I thought, working for Virgin, who gets that opportunity? So we wrote a pros and cons. I decided to make the decision to go. Had a great time. But now things are changing. Things out of my control. So there's now been the merger by CYBG.
Who are taking the Virgin name?
Who are taking the Virgin name.
So your call was probably absolutely right.
Yeah, taking the Virgin name. But that does impact on me personally, which I've been asked by a couple of people, you know, would you have made that decision to leave that fantastic role you were loving now? I still would. Because I've learned so much again, and again, I'm taking this on to my next role in the future.
Good, yeah, and I know obviously that will pan out. So maybe we'll have you back for a second round for the next part of your career. But maybe just the last section of this, we can talk a little bit about your thoughts on the future. And you've mentioned so many things as we've gone through this, but you've mentioned the importance of networks, of knowing your numbers, understanding what your budgets are, making sure you're spending to them or preferably less. But then I think, you know, almost all the way back to the beginning and the back of house, front of house, in our world, this industry has almost been turned on its head, where everyone now is talking about experience per square foot, about individuals at the workplace. Because we have flexible working, how do you get people to come into the office to create those moments where people are talking to each other rather than doing everything down a telephone or over a computer. So FM in a way has gone from being back of house to being very front of stage, to use a National Theatre analogy.
Oh,
there
well
you go.
Done, Michael.
Can you talk a little bit about where you see our business, the business of real estate, going over the next few years? How critical is that? Is it the experience of the employee that we're all striving to maximise to get the right productivity?
I think it's one part of it. I think maybe because my role has incorporated all aspects of real estate and FM, I see the industry becoming way more blended. So, you know, having a real estate team and having a very separate FM team, I think is not a recipe for success. I think there has to be a real blend of those. And as soon as you really have your vision and strategy, you then dovetail your FM service to support that. And I think underpinning all of that is, what do you want your colleague experience to be? And it's not always the right thing to have, you know, your foosball tables, your PlayStations. It might be more about actually your colleagues feeling valued, that they can actually be trusted to deliver by output and work more flexibly. And if there's one thing that all the way through my career I've seen again and again is that adopting that approach has a really positive impact. And I think there's going to be a lot more emphasis on workplace culture and the meaning of it, how you can really understand that sort of return on investment by really developing a fantastic culture, I think is something that is something I'm really interested to get to know a bit more about.
And you touched on it a little bit with the headhunter role when you said, you know, the chairs were uncomfortable, they were really sweating the assets, but that turnover was high.
Yeah.
And you've also talked a couple of times at RSA and then there that you had HR as an ally. Mm. Can you just talk a little bit more, and I guess finance is an ally, but talk maybe a little bit about the within a business and outside of the real estate team, who are the important stakeholders that you need to get information from and if you like use to make your case?
Mm. So I find it really important to understand the business that you're in. So actually, there's certain businesses that you do need to be in the office every day, but you only get that by meeting and really getting under the skin of the leaders in the business. What do they really want from their teams? Because you don't want to misalign what your thoughts are and deliver something that they're certainly not interested in. So I think really understanding the business operation. And I have done through my career a couple of back to the floors and actually worked not back to the FM floor, but actually back to the business floor and understanding what the business does. And when you start really understanding that, you can really add the value. I think the other thing is comms. So I think corporate comms and how you can really demonstrate the culture visually in the office and really bring it to life. And actually working with them on some really cost-effective ways of doing it and having it sort of live, living, changing. I think having allies with, I mean, I think it's all areas of the business. I mean, obviously IT and the whole technology piece is when we talk about the future, that's where it's going to be with the whole, you know, AI and everything from having fingerprint technology from walking in to having smart buildings. I think all of that is definitely going to be the sexy stuff, but also, again, you know, making buildings more efficient, make them work for you more.
All of that is really, I agree, all of that is almost a given now, isn't it? We know as new technology comes through, we need to figure out how to use it. So how can we use AI to do things more efficiently and what's the return on the investment? But you mentioned culture, which is obviously much harder to understand and then put into practice. And one small aspect of that, of course, is sustainability, which, you know, as a generalizer, it's becoming increasingly important. I mean, I can remember 10, 15 years ago working with BP and they were championing it, as were Shell, but it tended to be quite a niche section of certain industries. Whereas I think today it's across the board. You see it across finance, insurance, and everywhere. But is that something that plays into how you design a workspace and the culture?
Absolutely. And I think sustainability and I've talked about that over all my career, or it's been part of my plans. But I think what has been interesting is when there's been a decision in the past, I'm talking probably 10 years ago, on making an investment in something more sustainable. At the time, the business is like, well, actually, cost is more important. So actually, don't invest in the most energy efficient a handling unit or whatever it may be, or chiller or whatever, or lighting. So, but I think now it's way more in people's vision and focus. And I do think that is definitely something that is going to continue to be a focus, but also it's something that makes us a bit more out there, a bit more sexy, if you like. Because I think as a function, we are often seen as buildings and quite dry. I think anything that we can bring it to life in terms of sustainability, when you link it with cost and utilities, that's great. But also when you link it to actually developing a great culture by, you know, doing things that everybody can get involved in, I think.
Yeah, so it makes it a bit more human, which I think is maybe where the industry's going. It's about individuals and what individuals want and need, or at least it would be nice to think it was that, as you say, as opposed to just what's the lowest cost, we'll do that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really liked at Virgin that we did was having real culture clubs that I think make a difference, having events that everybody were interested in. But also what we used to do as a function, we flash mobbed. So we went
you
up
did, sorry,
to,
you did what?
Flash mobbed. Yeah.
What does that mean?
So we went up onto a working floor and we went along with IT colleagues, we went along with HR, and we all wore T-shirts. You know, we're the facilities team, we're here to help you. So we just arrived on the floor and say, hi, what are your problems? What's keeping you awake at night from an FM perspective? That flashing light will sort it. And actually, we really got in the face of our customers. And if you plan it well enough, so it's not in some very high-pressured sort of end of month, whatever. Yeah. Sales drive. It can really work well. And again, putting that sort of face to the team, I think, has been really good, and working with the other departments as well.
Yeah, so I like that idea, and it's about being creative and figuring out what will help people and making what you do, if you like, come to life, be more human, rather than it just being about we've paid the rent, we've cleaned the loos, we've cleaned the windows and supplied some food. Interesting. Okay, maybe sort of final kind of bit and wrap up. So, I mean, that is the most interesting career, a set of careers, I should say, that I've come across, and I thought I knew you. So, but now we go. I'm just sort of take it all the way back to Louise being at university or doing a higher national diploma. What would you be telling your 20-something year old self now?
Okay.
Advice would you have? Because I think you've touched on so many great things and you've made it sound easy, and we all know it's not easy.
I have always had a philosophy of you only have one life. Sadly, my father passed away when I was quite young. I've got a daughter with disabilities, and I just think you have one shot at it, right? So just step off the cliff. When you have a chance, go for it. I think the other thing I would say is, if you don't get too pigeonholed, you know, make sure you've got a rounded experience. If you're at uni, go and get a Saturday job, whether that be in a restaurant, coffee shop, garden centre, just go and deal with people. I think as I've interviewed people over the years, that's the thing that I would advise, and I have advised them, is just get experience. And I think that is crucial. Also, believe in yourself. And yeah, I don't have a first class honours from Cambridge, or I'm not a dentist like my sister, but actually I'm okay. I'm an operator and I can deal with people at all levels. So I would say to them, definitely, you know, believe in yourself.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And with that, I'd really like to thank you. It's been a fascinating 40 minutes or so, and I've certainly learnt a lot. So good. And hopefully we'll get you back for round two.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You're welcome.